This program is about unsolved mysteries. Whenever possible, the actual family members and police officials have participated in recreating the events. What you are about to see is not a news broadcast.
In 1992, Wendy Camp of Oklahoma City, her young daughter, and her sister-in-law vanished after being dropped off in a department store parking lot. Their mysterious disappearance was a culmination of a bitter feud between two families, which has now escalated to accusations of kidnapping and murder. Meet Joseph Prussianowski, a devout Hasidic Jew, a dedicated father of 12, and one of the most brilliant con men ever encountered. Authorities believe his international banking scams have netted illegal profits in excess of $200 million. Soo Young Kim and his wife Soo Ya came to the United States to build a better life. Then on a fateful day in 1991, Soo Ya left home to go shopping. She never returned, and the Kim's American dream was brutally shattered.
Also tonight, the poignant search for a remarkable teacher whose patience and understanding forever changed the life of one of her students. Join me. Perhaps you may be able to help solve a mystery. To meet a master con artist named Joseph Prussianowski. During an astonishing 18-year crime spree, Prussianowski has allegedly defrauded financial institutions around the world. Estimates of his total thefts range as high as $200 million. But this savvy swindler is a study in paradox. Prussianowski belongs to a deeply religious movement of Judaism known as the Hasidim. When he is not orchestrating one of his grand frauds, Prussianowski will, as likely as not, be in temple praying. The Hasidim pray several times a day, and out of respect to God, always cover their heads. All forms of labor, even driving, are forbidden on the Sabbath. Hasidic men do not shave or cut their hair, in keeping with a tradition handed down through the centuries. In contrast to their austere appearance, the Hasidim believe in the joyous celebration of God's work.
Hasidics are basically Jewish fundamentalists. They all live very, very simple lives. They believe in actually having a community that is apart from the surrounding world. They, in fact, rely very little on the surrounding world, and so therefore are a people who, by their own choice, tend to be apart from everybody else.
By adhering to strict religious values, the Hasidim have acquired a reputation for honesty and rock-solid integrity. It was a perfect camouflage for Joseph Prussianowski. By all accounts, Joseph Prussianowski abides by the religious dictates of the Hasidic Jews, except when it comes to the eighth commandment, "Thou shalt not steal." Joseph Prussianowski settled in Canada in the late 1960s. He and his family, which grew to include 12 children, lived in a Hasidic community near Montreal. Prussianowski supposedly ran an export-import business from the basement of his modest home. The reality was quite different. A 1985 swindler is typical of Prussianowski's ambitious schemes. His first step was to open his own bank. A clerical assistant named Alan Feingold unwittingly helped with the arrangements.
So, Alan, you have maybe for me the recommendations of the locations for the bank? Yes, I have everything you've been asking for. I recommend that we go with Anguilla.
Anguilla?
Yes.
The Caribbean island of Anguilla is notorious for some of the most lenient banking standards in the world. Prushanowski supplied two names to be the owners or principals of his bank. What Alan Feingold didn't know was that Prushanowski had made up the names.
All we need now are the signatures of our principals. That's all that's required.
But here we go.
But these are stamps.
Yeah, but they give me the authorization to use the signatures. They're very, very busy men, you know.
Is it proper to use stamps on forms of this kind?
The application form required a witness. So I witnessed the signatures. I mean, which I found out afterwards wasn't exactly a legally accepted procedure, that you one, according to the law, can only witness a person signing and not a signature stamp.
Alan, you got the checks here?
Yes, these are the checks.
Let me take a look here. Let me see here.
Chartering an actual bank was a measure of Prushanowski's sophistication. He could now issue official-looking bank cashier's checks, infinitely more convincing than mere personal checks.
By the way, on this, I have the list here of checks I want you should type out. The ones with the numbers are the most important ones. Okay?
All right, I'll get right to this.
You get the work on that.
The second step of Prushanowski's swindle was to write out checks in amounts of up to $1 million, supposedly guaranteed by the bank in Anguilla. He would then deposit the checks in business accounts he had set up around the world.
So, Alan, I'm going to go upstairs and have dinner with your wife and the kids. You call me if you need me, all right?
All right.
Mr. Bennett.
Mr. Prushanowski.
That's right. Yes.
Prushanowski would then contact the bank in person or by phone.
Please come in.
With his phenomenal talent for persuasion, Prushanowski convinced the bankers to advance him large amounts of cash, even though the checks had not yet cleared.
Before I endorse this, I need the cash advance of $750,000.
Mr. Prushanowski, it's the policy of our bank to wait 14 days after a deposit before you can draw on your account.
So all I'm asking for is $750,000.
He's a very clever, very, very persuasive man, a man who trades on his being a very religious person when he deals with banks.
We're going to have to wait just a few more
very
days.
Good at persuading them to cash his checks written on funny banks in faraway places with strange-sounding names.
All right, Mr. Prushanowski, okay. We're going to make an exception this time, but please, in the future, give us 14 days before
eventually,
you start drawing
on the checks all bounced, or most of them bounced. By the time the bouncing stopped, the bank was $1 million short.
Nice to see you. Okay. Take that over to window seat.
Right over there. Thank you very much. Have a nice
Thank
day.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Meanwhile, Alan Feingold found himself fielding calls from angry bankers demanding their money.
Yes. No, Mr. Prushanowski is not here today.
Ultimately, a Japanese company would file a lawsuit against Prushanowski and
yes,
his
sir.
Assistant, Alan Feingold.
We have many accounts with you.
He being sued for $1 million was something relatively shocking to me, and I didn't understand what was going on here, being cited as a co-defendant.
Feingold's faith was completely shattered in March of 1987 when agents of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police descended on an office Prushanowski kept in Montreal.
What do I ask you about Mr. Prushanowski?
Oh, give up, Mr. Prushanowski, what has happened?
When was
to
the
him?
Last time you saw Mr. Prushanowski?
I saw Mr. Prushanowski here at the office yesterday afternoon.
Are you familiar with the term bank fraud?
Bank fraud? No, Mr. Denis, nothing has happened. I mean,
Alan Feingold was hired by Prushanowski when he was 21 years old. He was very naive. He didn't know very much about the business world. So he could not even contemplate the possibility that Prushanowski had a criminal mind whenever he was asked to do things for him.
Alan Feingold was cleared of any involvement. He actively assisted efforts to unravel Prushanowski's complex ripoffs.
This is it.
Canadian authorities also raided Prushanowski's home, but came up empty-handed. The basement office had been cleared out, and Prushanowski had fled, taking his wife and 10 of his children with him. His oldest son and daughter were to join him later.
Mr. Ross, do you know what sort of work your father does here?
I don't know. It's just his business.
Do you do work with your father?
No.
From his Canadian operations, Prushanowski left a trail of ripoffs totaling more than $2 million. It was just a hint of what was yet to come.
After Joseph Prushanowski left Montreal.
He has his address.
He disappears off the face of the earth. No one seems ever to see him, hear from him again. But what then happens is all of a sudden, Joseph Weiss starts to appear. And Joseph Weiss operates fraud on exactly the same way that Joseph Prusinowski did.
It didn't take much to figure out that Joseph Weiss and Joseph Prusinowski were one and the same. But now, the swindles are becoming almost absurdly large. Between 1990 and 1992, financial institutions in Sweden lost more than $19 million. In Denmark, more than $39 million. The Netherlands, $32 million. England, $37 million. $30 million in the United States, and more than $35 million in Australia. The astounding total worldwide was more than $190 million.
If I got, I would give you, all right?
Finally, this master con man came up with one more brilliant strategy, one that keeps him safely beyond the reach of the law. In many cases, Prusinowski brazenly negotiated to give back a portion of the stolen money.
That's $1.5 million, okay? 50 cents on the dollar. Better than that, I could never do.
He knows that banks don't like to go to the police. They don't like to prosecute people. What they want is their money back.
I'll give them back to you in 3 days, all right?
So they will settle. And what that, of course, does is, by and large, it removes the lender from being a complainant to create a criminal prosecution problem for Prusinowski in that particular country. And he's used that tactic very successfully all over the world.
However, a few banks are unwilling to settle. And today, warrants for Prusinowski's arrest are outstanding in Canada and the United States. The stunning fact that Joseph Prusinowski has convinced one bank after another to hand over hundreds of millions of dollars naturally raises the question of what he does with all that money.
What is unique about Joseph Prusinowski is there is no evidence that he has actually personally benefited in any way at all from these frauds. The evidence is such that you have to accept that Prusinowski's frauds have largely had to benefit, I believe indirectly, not directly, his own community and other similar Hasidic communities.
Authorities believe Prusinowski uses the stolen funds to start up numerous legitimate businesses. In turn, the profits from these companies are given to the Hasidic community, which remains unaware of the criminal origin of the money.
Prusinowski, I think, likes to see himself as a Robin Hood figure. It's a way of giving a rationalization to what he does.
I feel that it has caused irreparable damage for the Jewish community, as I say, around the globe, because it helps to portray an image of Jewish, religious Jewish people, or Jewish people in general, as being crooks and robbers, which, of course, is not the truth as to the basic doctrines of our faith and how we practice.
This mugshot, the only known picture of Joseph Prusinowski, was taken when he was 42 years old. At the time, he was in a Connecticut prison on a fraud conviction. Prusinowski is now 54. He's 5'9" tall, weighs around 170 pounds, and probably has a full beard. Next, charges of child abuse, kidnapping, and murder tear two families apart. There is no such thing as a routine disappearance. Last year in Oklahoma, two women and a young girl suddenly and mysteriously dropped from sight. When authorities began to investigate, they unexpectedly found themselves in the midst of a bitter dispute between two families. At the center of the controversy is 24-year-old Wendy Camp. She, her daughter Cynthia, and her sister-in-law Renee were last seen in May of 1992. The truth remains tangled in an angry barrage of charges and countercharges, child abuse, kidnapping, and murder.
It all began rather innocently during the spring of 1987. Wendy was divorced and her daughter Cynthia was less than 6 months old. Wendy was working at an ice cream parlor in Edmond, Oklahoma, when she fell in love with a coworker named Chad Noh.
So, are we still on tonight?
Yeah.
They hit it off fairly quickly and started a relationship. And then she got pregnant with her second child. And he convinced her to marry him. And they got married about 3 or 4 weeks before Jonathan was born.
Just 1 month after Jonathan's birth, Wendy developed a crippling case of multiple sclerosis. Both her health and her marriage disintegrated. Wendy was hospitalized for nearly a year. Chad filed for divorce and was awarded primary custody of Jonathan.
Of course, along with the MS, I didn't think she would be able to help me raise my child. And instead of having two children to deal with, I just decided that it was best if we got a divorce and I helped or raised the child on my own.
Reach up and put this ring on this ring.
Wendy was too ill to contest the court's decision. For about 2 years, she struggled through physical therapy just to regain simple skills such as eating and walking.
That's it. Put this ring right there.
During this time, friends introduced Wendy to Leon Kemp. They were married in 1990 and set up housekeeping in Oklahoma City. Wendy's daughter, Cynthia, lived with them, and by all accounts, Leon proved to be the loving father she needed. As Wendy's condition improved, she began to ask her ex-husband, Chad, for visits with Jonathan, now 3 years old. Everyone agrees that at first, the visitations went smoothly. Jonathan spent a few weekends with Wendy and Leon in 1990. Then, according to Wendy's mother, Chad's family began to sabotage the visits.
She would call and make an appointment with them, set up a time and everything for her to see him, and she would go there and they would not be at home. And then they kept moving and getting unlisted phone numbers, this type of thing. So it was almost impossible to keep track of them.
Or hurting, you know.
Chad Noh remembers it differently.
She was allowed to visit him whenever she wanted. And there was never really any hard feelings up until the time that my grandma or my mother informed me that he was being sexually molested. And then that's whenever the visitations were cut off.
There was no molestation, not whatsoever. And the idea of them thinking, it just tore me up inside. I was mad.
The visitation squabble had escalated sharply, with Chad and his family now accusing Leon of criminal sexual abuse. However, the charges could neither be proven nor disproven. The court cited Chad for contempt and ordered him to allow Wendy and Leon's visits to resume. For more than 6 months, Chad refused. Hello. Then on May 29th, 1992,
Hello,
he had a sudden change of heart.
Oh, yeah, that would be great. That would be just great. Chad is going to let me see Jonathan today. All right.
Chad even said his mother, Beverly Noh, would pick Wendy up since a multiple sclerosis had left her unable
to
drive.
Chad is going to let me see Jonathan today. Beverly's going to pick me up at 11
o'clock. I didn't want Wendy going by herself because I didn't trust these people. And me and Chad didn't get along, and I was just, something inside of me, I just felt like she better not go by herself.
Well, I thought I might.
By the time Beverly arrived, Leon had convinced his sister, Renee Krieger, to accompany Wendy and Cynthia on the trip.
When do you think y'all will be back tonight?
Oh, a couple hours, probably around supper time.
Well, you be careful. You make sure you call me. You hear?
All right, I will.
All right, I love you.
Love you too, babe.
I kissed Wendy goodbye first, and they got in the car and took off, and I waved at them. That was the last time I seen them.
The 115-mile drive to Chad's home in Shamrock, Oklahoma, took just over 2 hours. When the group arrived in town at about 1:45 p.m., Wendy telephoned Leon.
Hi, babe. We're fine. We're fine. We're just at the cafe. We're waiting for Chad to get here.
Okay, the first time she called me that day was about 1 something to let me know that she'd made it all right.
We sat there and visited, and she didn't even really play with Jonathan. Her and Jonathan and Cynthia played for a while, but she mostly sat there and drank coffee with me out on the porch and talked.
Around 4:15, it was time for Wendy to say goodbye to Jonathan.
You'll be good for Daddy, okay?
Then she, Cynthia, and Renee climbed into Beverly's car for the ride back to Oklahoma City. They were joined by Chad's grandmother, Ida Pruitt. Before leaving Shamrock, Wendy called Leon again.
We'll be home in just a few hours. Beverly's ready to leave now. Okay. Bye-bye.
At about 4:30, 4:45, she called me to let me know how the visit went. She said that Beverly was in a hurry, so she had to get off the phone, and that was the last I talked to her.
Phone company records verify that Wendy called Leon at 4:42 p.m., but virtually everything else about that afternoon has become tainted by suspicion. The last people known to have seen Wendy and her companions alive were Beverly Noe and Ida Pruitt, Chad's mother and grandmother. Beverly declined to participate in this broadcast. What follows is Ida Pruitt's account of the trip. The visit took place here in Shamrock. After taking Wendy, Cynthia, and Renee to Oklahoma City, Beverly was to drive back to Cushing, where she planned to meet Chad in a restaurant between 7 and 8 p.m.
Now, Chad is never at the house. Chad doesn't spend any time with
Chad
him.
Chad is a good father, and he provides for his son. Now, there
according
are
no to Ida, Wendy was unpleasant company from the very beginning.
Beverly, he's used to being with me. That's what he needs.
I think so. I think a child like him
needs stability in his life.
I think he needs the stability of us. And I'm a little concerned about your multiple sclerosis, dear. Now,
what
I know
he needs
you have been
is to spend some time with his mother.
Now, how
and
can
all
you
this time, all the way to town, she's just griping and bitching. And that's all she could do. So after they got back in the car and everything, I told Beverly, I said, just take me back home. I said, you got to put up with this, but I don't. So she brought me back home, and then she went on.
Ida Pruitt says she was dropped off at around 5:15 p.m. She claims Beverly later told her that the bickering continued for the next half hour.
Now, there was no reason for you to upset Ida like that. That was totally uncalled for, Wendy. She loves that little boy.
I love him, too. That's why I want to spend more time with
him. You get enough time to spend with him, but he needs me, he needs his grandma, he needs
his
father.
She said that the time she got to Chandler, she had had just about all she could stand. And she pulled in Walmart and told him to get out.
Beverly has told police that she pulled into a shopping center parking lot in Chandler, 45 miles from Wendy's home. She then ordered Wendy, Cynthia, and Renee out of the car. They never returned home. They never called. They never asked anyone for help. It was as though they had dropped off the face of the earth.
About 8 o'clock that night, I started thinking, well, they should have been home by now. And then midnight that night, I said, this has gone too far. I've got to call the police. And I did, and they came out and took a brief description of everything.
We did an aerial search, which involved 4 and 5 airplanes searching a 5-county area. It also involved several search teams, and nothing was discovered at that time.
The bizarre disappearance was a talk of Oklahoma City for days. With no other leads in the case, Beverly Noe's version of the afternoon's events became the focus of intense official scrutiny.
At the time that Beverly Noe left Shamrock, Oklahoma, which would have been between 4:30 and 5 in the evening, she agreed to meet her son, Chad, in Cushing at a restaurant at 7 that evening. It could not have been done in that small amount of time.
According to authorities, Beverly had told Chad she would meet him just 2 hours after she left Shamrock. Even though the trip from Shamrock to Oklahoma City and back to Cushing would take 3 hours to drive. In addition, Beverly took the old 2-lane highway instead of the faster superhighway. Wendy's family is also disturbed about Wendy's failure to telephone from the shopping center.
Wendy was very, very dependent upon Leon, and she'd already called twice. She would have immediately gone in and called her husband, Leon, or if she wasn't able to get a hold of him, she would have called me. I feel that my daughter and my granddaughter and the sister-in-law were murdered that Friday night. I feel that Ida, Beverly, and Chad, all three are involved. I feel that they pretty well had their plans laid out on what they were going to do when they made the phone call to ask Wendy if she wanted to see Jonathan. And I figure whoever got in that car, they were going to do what they had planned to do.
Beverly and I did not have nothing to do with their disappearances, and I know this. I don't care whether they know it or not or believe it, but I know it.
There is no way that I or my grandma or my mother could have killed them or shipped them off somewhere or are still holding them.
In spite of Chad's denials, two residents of Shamrock have told authorities that they overheard him boasting that he had killed Wendy, Cynthia, and Renee, but that no one would ever find their bodies.
Maybe in one of my drunken stupors, I might have popped up, oh yeah, yeah, I did it, but there ain't no way in ever I could have did something like that. I'm not a violent person.
Despite all the bitter recriminations between the two families, no physical evidence has ever been found to indicate what happened to Wendy Camp, Cynthia Brito, and Renee Krieger. 3 months after they disappeared, a woman who knows the family claimed to have seen Cynthia alive. Police believe the account is credible. However, there have been no further sightings for more than a year. We return. A woman needs your help to find the teacher who turned her life around. Forty-five-year-old Dolores Brooks has spent much of her life in the same section of Brooklyn, New York she knew as a young girl. Her thoughts frequently turn to her childhood and a special friend Dolores hasn't seen since she herself was a teenager more than 25 years ago. In the early 1960s, Dolores moved to Brooklyn from a small town in North Carolina. She was a shy country girl, overwhelmed by the crowds and the concrete jungle that was New York City.
It was really a big culture shock in reference to the buildings being so tall and everything, because in North Carolina, people used to come from miles around just to see a three-story building, so it was really a big deal.
Dolores suffered the awkwardness common to many teenagers. That was complicated by strained relations at home and the anxiety of entering a big city school.
The kids, they seemed to be so knowing, the New York kids, and being a Southern girl, you know, I just didn't feel that I fit in at that time.
As Dolores began her first semester at Decatur Junior High, she was shocked by her classmates' rowdy behavior. She never dreamed that in the midst of the chaos, she was about to meet the person who would change her life. The new music teacher, Madeline Strauss, was an outsider just like Dolores.
Please sit down. Excuse me.
So she really looked like a uptown girl. She didn't look like the type that would be teaching at this school. You know, she really looked stylish.
Now, this first piece I'm going to play for you is by a man named Wolfgang Amadeus.
A new day had dawned in music class. Dolores would soon discover that life offered much more than problems and conflict. Her eyes were open to the beauty in the world, thanks to Madeline Strauss.
She really loved music, and she demanded that we loved it, too. If we didn't love it, we had to be quiet about it and respect it. But eventually, music, it comes through to everyone, and we all did love it.
Hi, Dolores. Come on in. Thanks for coming. I really appreciate it.
By the following school year, Madeline had become a friend to Dolores, as well as a teacher. Dolores was frequently invited to visit the apartment where Madeline lived with her father.
The first time I went to her apartment, it was really overwhelming. Such a beautiful place and so much space, I couldn't get over that. I didn't know it was luxury. It looked just like a big museum. She lived at least 30 floors up. I don't remember how many, but it was at least 30. And I would look out and I could see Central Park. This was really a new experience for me, you know. It was like walking out of one world into another. And I became like a changed person when I walked through those doors as the time went on.
Over the next 2 years, Madeline took Dolores to chamber concerts and other musical events, even lending her clothing and jewelry for these occasions. It was a life Dolores had only dreamed of, and it slowly nurtured a new self-image.
Once somebody cares about you, automatically your self-esteem picks up, you know. It wasn't anything that I can really explain that happened. But I just felt better about myself. I walked with my head up for once in my life, and I just felt more relaxed and at ease because someone cared about me and I knew it.
But listen, I want you to know you're a special girl. You're a smart girl.
Graduation Day, June of 1964.
And I want you to
a day of mixed emotions for Dolores Brooks.
Just for any reason, I'll be there for you still.
Leaving junior high meant that Madeline Strauss would no longer be a daily presence in her life. Without that positive influence, family problems would overwhelm Dolores. She ran away from home, dropped out of school, and eventually became a ward of the court. In 1966, Dolores was stricken with what she believes was Reye's syndrome, a potentially fatal condition that affects the brain. She spent nearly a month in the hospital, most of that time in a coma. Dolores recovered, but was left with partial amnesia. In the summer of 1967, Dolores was stopped on the street
Dolores?
By a woman who seemed to know her.
Dolores, oh my goodness, look at you. You look so great. I've missed you, how are you?
Do I know you?
Dolores, don't you remember me? It's me, Madeline, your music teacher.
Well, I hope I was a good student, but I have to go.
I didn't know who she was, you know. And I saw her maybe 3 to 4 times after that over the next year or so. And I still didn't remember her. And she would hug me in the street and act so glad to see me. And I didn't know who she was.
About 4 years ago,
Dolores went on to complete her education and trained as a practical nurse. She eventually moved to Chicago, where in 1982, her memories of Madeline Strauss were reawakened.
I grew up in Brooklyn, New York.
Excuse me, where are you from?
I'm from Brooklyn.
That's what I thought you said. What section?
Best Eye.
Me too. No kidding. What school did you go to?
Decatur Junior High School.
Yeah, that's where I went. I remember
really?
You.
Oh, yeah.
We were in the same music class. I sat right across from you.
Really?
Yeah, remember the teacher?
We start talking about our teachers, and Madeline came up. And from there,
yeah.
The memories start coming back.
Back to me.
Once the memory came back, I decided I would like to find her because I really realized how much we had in the past. And then when I met her on the street so many times and didn't know her, that I felt that I needed to see her again to let her know that it wasn't all lost, the time that she put into me. I would like to just say thank you.
Next, a family's dream of a better life in America ends in tragedy. New York City has traditionally served as a beacon for those who look to America for a new and better life. Nearly every country in the world has an immigrant community enriching the city, and to the newly arrived, New York symbolizes the American dream. Soo Young Kim and Soo Ya Yu lived that dream. Born in South Korea, they worked hard and saved every penny. In 1981, they married in Seoul, then moved to the United States. Soo Young and Soo Ya worked in flea markets until they were able to open two stores, one in Long Island and the other in Bushwick, a section of Brooklyn known for its ethnic diversity.
My wife and I were very nervous about our opening. We cleaned and set up everything together. There was no single item in the store not touched by her. We worked very hard from early in the morning till late at night 7 days a week. And we were blessed with fortune and happiness.
Good size and good color for men.
As the business grew, so did the Kim family. Soo Ya and Soo Young had two sons, and often the whole family could be found at the Brooklyn store.
10% discount.
The Kims eventually moved to a spacious apartment in Queens. There on the afternoon of June 29, 1991, just 5 days after Soo Young and Soo Ya had celebrated their 10th wedding anniversary, Soo Ya left the boys with her grandmother while she went out shopping.
Okay, not too much time with this, huh?
When Soo Ya walked out of the apartment that day, no one imagined that the Kims' American dream was about to come crashing down. When Soo Young Kim came home from the store at 8 p.m., he was worried to find that Soo Ya had not returned from her shopping trip. He called all her friends, but no one knew where she was. Eventually, Soo Young's brother joined the vigil. Soo Young's concern mounted after he found Soo Ya's car still parked in the garage, its engine stone cold.
My wife had never been out that late for the 10 years of our marriage. I was getting more and more worried. I could not stop thinking that something bad must have happened to her. I stayed up all night waiting for her, but she did not return home.
The next day, Soo Young Kim was summoned to the medical examiner's office to identify a body.
I could not and did not want to believe what was going on. As soon as I recognized my wife's body, I felt everything was over. The whole world seemed to crush upon me. I could not think of anything else except my children.
Soo Ya Kim had been stabbed 9 times, her body dumped in the section of Brooklyn known as Bedford-Stuyvesant, 7 miles from the Kims' apartment in Queens. Although she was nude, there was no evidence of rape. Soo Ya's murder appeared to be yet another senseless act of random violence. But unlike many random crimes, this one had a witness. Joe Jones was a private security guard hired to patrol an abandoned building in Bedford-Stuyvesant. Around 3 a.m., 10 hours after Soo Ya had disappeared, Jones noticed a man behind the building.
Hey, yo, man, you can't dump there.
I can't dump here?
No, you can't dump here.
He, like, hesitated, you know, a couple seconds. Bucks? Then he said, what if I give you $20? So I said, yeah, okay. So So at that time, when I'm taking the $20, I see that he had blood on him, you know? So I said, yo, how you get blood? How you get blood on you like that?
I just got into a fight.
The man's demeanor made Joe Jones suspicious. He got a brief glimpse of the license plate before the car backed out.
He gets in a car, drive away, but he stops at the corner. So when he stopped at the corner, I'm still standing there. You know, I think he thought I was gonna go back and see what he put in the garbage. And I really got suspicious when he drove to the corner and was looking at me, and I was looking at him. So when I went back, I looked on the ground, I saw spots of blood going towards the garbage can.
Get that bag open.
Joe Jones recruited a friend who happened by. Together, they cautiously probed the contents of the dumpster. Amidst layers of debris, they saw a woman's hand. It was the body of Suya Kim. In an uncanny coincidence, the first vehicle to pass by was an ambulance, but it was too late. Suya had already been dead for hours. Thanks to Joe Jones, however, police had a description of the killer and his car.
We ran all the Nissans that fit that description with that plate number in New York City, and we tried to match registered owners by using that partial plate. And we were able to come up with one match.
Thank you. Could you do me a favor?
The vehicle was registered to a Taiwanese exchange student at CW Post College in Long Island. Okay. She said she had not driven it since about 10 o'clock the night before.
After dinner.
You went after dinner?
Yes.
And what time did you get back in?
I come home 10.
Okay, did you go anywhere after that?
No, I stay home.
Okay.
Suya had been stabbed repeatedly, yet there was no blood in or on the car. When police checked the engine, they found that the car had, in fact, not been driven for hours.
All right, does anyone have an extra set of keys to your car?
No, only I.
So you're the only driver? You didn't let anyone borrow the car last night?
No.
At this time, we don't have any other clues. The plate number came up to a car that was a blue Nissan that fit the description that Mr. Jones told us. However, it wasn't the car. We don't believe it was the car at this time.
I don't understand it, you know. It is a mystery, you know, because I thought once I gave them the license plates in the car, they could pick them up. But then when they found the car, they said this wasn't the car. So I don't know.
Police now began to look at their star witness, Joe Jones, as a suspect. They requested that Jones take a lie detector test. He passed with flying colors. The police are positive he had nothing to do with Suya's murder. For nearly 2 years, Soo-young Kim stayed on in the United States, but the memories of Suya proved too painful to bear. In April of 1993, he shut down his business and returned with his two little boys to Korea.
I could not stand being in the store anymore because everything there reminded me of my wife. Now, there are no good memories for me here in America. Since it happened, I lost all my hope and dream. I have suffered so much. I'm still struggling hard to get over my wife's death. For the sake of our children, I still truly love her and miss her.
Police have one particular theory which may yet help identify Suya's killer. The dumpster in Bedford-Stuyvesant was not easily visible from the street, so police believe the killer may be a delivery man or a cab driver, someone with detailed knowledge of the neighborhood. The suspect is in his mid-20s and approximately 5 feet 6 inches tall. He has blonde hair and blue eyes and weighs between 130 and 140 pounds. When last seen, he was wearing a torn and blood-stained fishnet tank top with blue and white jogging shorts, which had yellow sailboat insignias on the leg. On our next Unsolved Mysteries, with Halloween just around the corner, a ghostly tale seems in order. And in Lake Wales, Florida, you you'll find a haunted house that apparently has it all. An alluring phantom, a shadowy specter, and a demonic possession. Join me next time for this lively tour of the spirit world and much more on Unsolved Mysteries.